KUTI
Irvine. The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to this August 28th, 2013 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org, and we are always available via podcast. I'll give you more information about how to access our podcast later in the show. I'm your guest host, Marie Stone, and as always, Writers on Writing is dedicated to the art and business of books. Each week, Barbara DeMarco Barrett is here with authors, poets, agents, giving you the latest and most up-to-date information on the publishing world. I'm joined this morning by Saeed Sarafidzai, author of the short story collection Brief Encounters with the Enemy, and coming up in the second half hour, C.E. Poverman will be here to discuss his latest novel, Love by Drowning. Saeed Sarafidzai is the author most recently of the short story collection Brief Encounters with the Enemy. He is the recipient of the 2012-2013 Fiction Fellowship from the Coleman Center of Scholars and Writers at the New York Public Library, and the author of the critically acclaimed memoir When Skateboards Will Be Free, which he received the Whiting Writers Award. It was selected as one of the 10 best books of the year by Dwight Garner of the New York Times. His short stories and personal essays have appeared in The New Yorker, The Paris Review, Grantham, McSweeney's, The New York Times Magazine, Best American Non-Required Reading. Saeed teaches creative writing at NYU, where he received a 2013 Outstanding Teaching Award. The book, again, Brief Encounters with the Enemy, is published by Dial Press, a division of Random House. It is my pleasure to welcome him this morning. Saeed, hello.
Hello, Marie. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. Hello, California.
Sunny California.
Yeah, calling from sunny New York.
Yeah, perfect. The beauty of August, right?
Yeah.
So I'm going to give you a chance to introduce the collection, because no one does it as well as the writer himself. Talk a little bit about the collection as a whole and kind of what was germinating in your mind when you assembled it.
Well, the collection, it's 8 stories, and I had sort of as an impetus of war, loosely based on the last 10, 12 so years of war that we've been at, but the war in the collection is never named. It's sort of just happening overseas, and really maybe classified as more as a domestic book, as far as it's 7 out of the 8 stories take place in the United States in an unnamed post-industrial city, young men looking for love and employment and a future. And this is sort of the ideas that kind of evolved over the course of those 8 stories.
Yeah. I was interested, between the memoir that you wrote, some of the other short fiction that you've written, sort of your areas of concern for you as writer, as reader, and as human, and if those three things differ from each other, writer, reader, human, and kind of as you look across the body of what you've written thus far, if there are recurring themes that, your mind keeps struggling with.
Well, in my memoir, I recount my upbringing in the Socialist Workers' Party. Both my parents were longtime members, dedicated members. My father is Iranian. My mother's Jewish-American. So I've been inculcated, really since birth, in the idea of politics being essential to your life. And I really, kind of unfortunately, I guess, I can't escape it. I mean, I wrote the memoir, and I thought, okay, now I've put this to rest as far as my life just being so immersed in politics. But then when I started writing fiction, the politics reemerged again. It's in my blood. I mean, the angle I take in the collection is a completely different angle. You'll notice that in the collection, everybody's actually for war. They're all pro-war. And, of course, me growing up as a socialist, I was decidedly against war. But it's still there. The idea of war and politics and economy, it filters into all of my writing.
Yeah, I love that. You can't escape yourself, no matter...
Yeah, you think you are, actually, and then you realize you're not.
You're not, yeah.
Because I actually thought, when I was writing the collection, I thought, oh, this is so good, I'm being a different character, because now I'm writing, you know, pro-war, mainstream American. The characters in my book, and this is one of the most liberating things, they're all named, you know, Ike or Zeke or Luke. There's no, you know, I'm not writing from somebody who has a strange name. That's not the, you know, the narrator. So that was so liberating. But then when I take a step back, I go, oh, my God, I'm kind of talking about a lot of the same things I talked about in my memoir, or just that I've lived through my life.
Right, right. Just coming at it from a different angle, or trying to poke the skunk with a different stick or something, right? So I'm curious about why short stories. After doing the memoir, and what the short form gives you that maybe a longer form wouldn't, or kind of, I'm a huge, as any listener to the show knows, I'm a massive fan of the short story form. So, you know, I'm always seeking them out and intrigued by them, and I'm always wondering why writers choose that form over another.
You know, I don't know how conscious the decision was at first to do a short story. You know, after I finished the memoir, I was thinking, what am I going to write next? And I had a couple other nonfiction ideas in my head that I worked on for a little bit and then abandoned. And then literally one day I just started writing. I said, let me just sit down and write a short story. I hadn't had a whole lot of experience writing fiction. I'd written plays before, which are in a way fiction, but I hadn't, you know, I'd never written a novel. I hadn't written many short stories. So I was kind of coming at it as a novice, and I think it was a really nice little bite-sized chunk that I could work on and sort of hone my craft while doing it. Now, what happened as I began to write these stories, and they're all thematically linked, I think there's something interesting about a collection of stories where you can get the story speaking to one another in a more subtle way than you could if you're writing an entire novel. Mm-hmm. So what I enjoy is that the idea, I mean, one of the aspects of the book is that there's this war that it's either just about to begin, or it's already beginning, or it's about to end, or, you know, it's in a kind of continues. That's sort of my feeling that I've had these last, well, since, I mean, I'd actually go back to 1991 for the first Gulf War. Mm-hmm. There's always been this, the war, you know, if you look in the paper, it's like the war's, it's coming, it's here, now it's ending, now we're in the middle, you know. So there's always been this thing that I think with the stories, each story picks up the war at a different point, and it can kind of make a little subtle statement about what life has been like for us in the last 12 years or so.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the beauty of these interlinked short stories is that you get the story at the microcosm level of the story, and then the whole arc of the stories being in dialogue with each other, and kind of a bigger picture that you can step back from, and it's really
that's
nice.
Exactly right, and that's something I discovered midway through. I said, oh, I see, these can all now talk to each other.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about ordering them, because I know if the stories are in dialogue with each other, you know, I kind of read the collection skipping around a little bit.
Uh-huh.
I started linearly, and then I thought, I wonder if they work together, you know, if you just read the last one first. But I know, you know, it's a very conscious choice as to how to order them and how they build on each other. And talk a little bit about how you structure them.
Well, there is some linear aspect to it, because you begin the first story, the war has not begun. It's just sort of in the air. The following couple stories, now the war has arrived. What I like, though, is that there is, just to sort of throw a monkey wrench into it, there is one story where actually the war has ended, and the soldiers are coming back home. And then the following story, we're right back in the midst of it without any explanation, which is one of the wonderful things about writing a short story. You don't have to explain the preceding story.
Right.
But if you are reading them linearly, you'll see, wait a minute, I thought the war ended. No, now here it is, final story, the war has begun again, or we're actually in the middle of the war without any explanation. And again, that just goes back to that feeling of, like, where are we now in the war? Is it over? Is it still going? Are we leaving Afghanistan? Are we, you know, now we're going to go into Syria? There's not a clear delineation of the structure here with our, you know, military engagement.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the things. And then the final thing is the story number eight, the last story, has probably the the most happy ending of them all, and I wanted to, you know, leave it the reader on a, as much of a positive note as I could.
Did you write them linearly? I mean, did you sort of work on the collection?
No, that was, they were shuffled later.
Yeah, yeah.
They were shuffled later. Right, some of the stories, you know, story number five, I might have written last. I can't quite recall how it worked, but no, they weren't written linearly.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine they would be, but wouldn't that be convenient? But
right, right. Yeah, it was only after I stepped back and said, okay, what do I have? Okay, this is the situation. And then I was able to go, okay, this is the order that they would work well in.
Yeah, right, right. You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest this morning is Saeed Seyrafizadeh. The book is Brief Encounters with the Enemy. We were talking about this earlier, but your decision to sort of come at the war from different angles, and I'm wondering if any of these stories, either as a collection or individually, changed your mind about anything, either regarding the war or anything else. Did they crystallize feelings that you already had? Did they change your mind about how you view war?
That's a great question. My impulse is just to say, no, of course, it just confirmed everything I already knew because I'm the one writing it. But, you know, the characters in the collection are, they wouldn't be people I would, they, I guess to put it one way is they wouldn't be members of the Socialist Workers Party. They would not be people that we would, as a, growing up, I would have necessarily associated with or approved of or my parents would have approved of. For instance, one's a Walmart manager. And, of course, in the Socialist Workers Party, you don't approve of managers. Everybody's, you know, it's the worker that's noble. But I fell in love with these characters. And, of course, I had to be them for a while I was writing them. So, there was, I guess, a humanizing aspect to working on this book that I felt an affinity for people that I might not have when I was a child. And again, they're pro-war, or at least they don't question the war. They kind of all just take it as a matter of course, and that's an idea that would have been abhorrent to us, to my family. So that was another thing. But you, as a writer, you have to, I would think, begin to love your characters, and so that was something I think that was a little bit of a change for me.
Yeah, or at least have deep empathy for them.
Right.
Right.
And know where they're coming from and why they make the choices they make.
So tell me a little bit about mining these characters, kind of where they came from. Did you have templates in your real life that you sort of were thinking of when you fleshed these guys out and sort of how you accessed their head?
Well, I did. I grew up in Pittsburgh, and I based a lot of these characters on people that I would have known. And I based, you know, a lot of it is also me. It's sort of me imagining what my life might have been like if I had never left Pittsburgh when I did in my early 20s to go to New York City and try to be a writer. I've mentioned before that it's, or I've thought about it as sort of being a sequel to my memoir. But again, it's an imagined sequel. Pittsburgh, for me, you know, it's a post-industrial city, and I moved there in the 1970s. My mother and I moved from Brooklyn to Pittsburgh in 1975, and that was not the time to be moving to Pittsburgh because the steel industry was collapsing. And I think those initial early memories of that city and the feeling that it was on its way out has sort of really informed the mood of the book. And those people that I knew in Pittsburgh has informed a lot of these characters.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the setting really is another character in the book. It's so
right.
Visceral. And the weather. There's lots
right.
of weather.
That's right. All the weather and the city. And in early stories, I often thought, sort of my main goal was just to describe how does a city react to war. I wasn't necessarily thinking in terms of specific characters. Of course, there are specific intimate characters, but I like the idea of this is an entire city. We're going to see how this city deals with this change.
Yeah, right, right. Really nice. My guest this morning is Saeed Serafizadeh, the book Brief Encounters with the Enemy. Maybe I'll give you a chance to read a little bit from it now, and then we'll kind of launch into craft, nuts and bolts, putting it together questions.
Great. I'll read just briefly from, no pun intended, the story, A Brief Encounter with the Enemy, which is, I think, story number 4 in the collection.
Yeah, perfect.
To get to the hill, you have to first take the path. The path is narrow and steep and lined with trees that are so dark they could be purple, and so dense it feels as though you're walking alongside a brick wall. You can't see in, and you hope that no one can see out. The first time I went up the path, it was terrifying. I could barely take a full breath, let alone put one foot in front of the other. If I'd had to run, I wouldn't have remembered how. Besides, I was loaded down with 50 pounds of equipment that clanged and banged with every step. I might as well have been carrying a refrigerator on my back. But after the first month, the fear dissipated, and the path started to become fascinating, even charming. I was able to appreciate the beauty of the surroundings, as the brochure had said, even the trees that I was constantly bumping against. "What kind of trees are these?" I asked out loud. I wanted to learn everything I could. I wanted to get everything there was to get out of this experience. "Christmas trees," someone answered back. He was being funny, of course, and everyone laughed, even though we were missing Christmas. The sergeant wanted to know what was funny. We told him, "Nothing was funny, sir." He said that that was true. Nothing was funny. That if you could get shot in the face at any moment, then nothing could be funny. So we were quiet again, the 50 of us. We were fearful again. But that didn't last too long, because fear can't persist unless you have at least a little evidence to sustain it. Fascination can't persist either. What can persist, however, is boredom. I had come all this way hoping for something groundbreaking to happen, and nothing had happened. Now 12 months had passed, and tomorrow I was flying back home. That's what I was thinking about when I walked up the path for the last time.
That was fantastic.
I'll leave it there.
You know, you have such a great...
The folks can buy the book to
yeah,
see
to
what
hear
happens
the next. Right, right. You have such a great voice in the book. Do you read your material out loud to yourself when you're writing it to kind of get the sense of cadence and rhythm and language?
I don't. I don't read it out loud, but I do, unless... I think I sometimes catch myself mumbling. but I certainly hear the voice very clearly in my head, and I also work on it, you know, over and over to get that, to get the polished feel to it. But no, I don't think I do read it out loud.
You should. You're really good. You're really good
well,
at it.
You know, I used to be an actor, so some of that might be a little... I was a failed actor, so some of it might be me salvaging something from that career.
I love that. I was also thinking about the titles of the stories and the title of the collection. So that Brief Encounters with the Enemy is the only story that's titled, you know, more than one word. They all have brief, titles. And, I think in short stories in particular, titles always strike me as tricky because they have to be resonant. Maybe this is true of titles in general, but they have to be resonant on a lot of different levels and kind of off-kilter and not too literal. Talk a little bit about titling your stories.
Yeah, I think the titles, and you're right, because there's 8 stories and 7 of them are just one-word titles. And this might just seem so obvious, but I think I'm looking for a title that will resonate on some obvious level of what the story is about, but that will then have at least one other meaning beneath that, that the reader, after reading the story, will say, okay, I picked up on that. That somehow, that undercurrent that the title speaks to.
Right.
But I will point out that the title of the collection, and I think this could be interesting, the title of the collection is not the same as the title of the passage I just read, because that story is called A Brief Encounter with the Enemy.
Right, right.
And the title of the collection is called Brief Encounters with the Enemy.
Right, right.
In some way, I say I leave it up to the reader to draw their own decision idea of what is being said with that. I have certainly my ideas for it, but it was, I guess, a subtle nod to the way we read these titles.
Yeah, nice. And tell me, so you sit down to write, a story. Does it start with character? Does it start with an idea? Does it start with a scene in your head? Kind of all of the above. Tell me about those initial sort of germination ideas that you have when you begin.
It probably starts either with all of what you just said or some parts of it. It's generally, I think, very, very vague. I'd be lucky. The best case scenario is that I feel like I can see an arc. Even if it's a cloudy arc, I can see some sort of arc. The passage I just read, that story, A Brief Encounter with the Enemy, came somewhat fully formed in my head, just in that I knew this is going to be a story about a soldier going up a path in war, and that then something was going to happen at the end, and I knew what was going to happen at the end. And then, really, it's just a matter of me, and I'm not being funny with this, but it's really just a matter of me just, then I have to write 6,000 words between the beginning and the end, sort of fill it in. But knowing the end is such a wonderful thing. And that didn't always happen. Sometimes I had to, like, grasp at, I said, okay, I've got to try to figure out how to wrap this story up now, and I'm reaching for certain elements and trying to come to some sort of satisfying click of a conclusion. And sometimes, yeah, sometimes it is a character that I want to follow, or sometimes the characters just pop into my head. Mm-hmm. There's one story I wrote, Paranoia, it's the second story, mm-hmm. or the third story, where I had the first paragraph fully formed in my head. It was so wonderful. I worked on the first paragraph for, I don't know, an hour or 2 hours, and then I got to the second paragraph, and I had no idea what was going to happen. And suddenly this character popped into my head, and the story became about that character. So sometimes you just got to dive in. It's like going swimming. You know, don't even test the water. Just jump in. You'll figure it out once you're there, hopefully, or you'll drown. Either way.
It's funny you should say that, because the guest coming up wrote a novel, the premise of which is that this Marlin pulls the guy over the side of the ship, and I thought, what a great metaphor for writing, you know?
Of course.
This thing just
absolutely
drags you down to the bottom of the ocean.
Right, right. And you're flailing the whole way.
right. You know, your note about endings brings me to another point of short stories, which is that endings in short stories are so very different than in novels, and so very often, as in this collection, I don't know if unsettling is the word, but a bit unresolved. And I think knowing when to end a short story is a real art form for new writers, particularly. But and I often find that it's probably better to end it about a page before writers do, and then you chop it
right,
and
sure,
pare it back. Talk a little bit about when you know the ending is perhaps satisfying enough.
And that's the operative word, enough. Yeah, I think what I'm looking for in an ending is that there's going to be, and I'm not looking for resolution, but I'm looking for something that's been, something that's been answered or concluded in a way, which isn't the same as resolved. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking of the story Paranoia, where the ending that sort of came to me, I guess, midway through, and I'm scrambling to figure it out. The ending that I've chosen is going to be able to tie up at least one of the loose ends that ride through this story. And maybe that's all you can go for. And maybe that's why it's good to have more than one strain running through a story, because if you can tie up one of them, it's okay to leave the other ones hanging.
Mm-hmm. Were there characters in this collection that haven't left you alone after it's over that you think bear more exploration?
Yes, there are. I'm beginning a novel, and I've been wondering if I would bring in some of these characters into the novel. You know, some of it just feels like it could be expedient. Like, well, I've already developed this character, and I know this character, and I liked him or her, so why not recycle them in the novel? And also, that could be a delightful thing for someone who's read the collection, then would see this character appear, you know, elsewhere. So that I have been toying with some of that, and then of course I also feel like, oh, let's just start totally from scratch,
yeah,
if that's even something that one ever does.
Right, right. Were there characters in here who were particularly difficult to get into that you felt like you needed to access them, but something about them, you know, sort of prevented you from being able to do it easily, and kind of how you got into them ultimately?
I don't know if there were any characters that were difficult for me. I do remember that I worked for a long time on some scenes in stories because they didn't seem to be satisfactory enough, and I couldn't figure out what was wrong with it, and I wanted it to be more alive than I could seem to make it. That was more of the stumbling block. I think the characters themselves, once I thought of them, they I think almost came to me fully formed, and again, maybe that's part of the acting, my acting experience. Because one thing I do when I write, you were asking earlier about if I speak, you know, if I read it out loud, I do often think in terms of theater when I write, and think in terms of character, and in just even being on a stage and how would these bodies be moving, and what would an audience want to be seeing, and so I think some of that maybe has made it a little bit easier for me to have some of these characters. And also, a lot of these characters, you know, part of the problem with my acting career was because of my crazy long name, I was always being called in to audition for, you know, roles like deli owner and taxi cab driver and third world despot. I didn't have access to other roles that would have been perfectly within my scope. And in the collection, I'm able to now play all of those roles.
That's nicely observed. That's, yeah, interesting. Sadly, we're drawing down on our time. Do you have last minute words of advice for writers? Wisdom, advice?
Oh, God, I could go on forever. And then as soon as I'd give the advice, I'd ask for advice back. Well, I would say to those aspiring writers out there, I'd give two manageable bits of advice. And one is to set yourself some sort of schedule. Don't wait for inspiration to strike. So that means if you're going to write, you know, 1 hour every 3 days, or you'll write one page on Monday and Thursday, whatever it is, and even if it's a small amount, it's okay because that will add up. And then the other thing I would say is put your work out there. Send it out places. Let yourself be rejected from magazines and websites. And coming up against rejection and coming up against editors will help you hone your own skill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great advice. Great advice. Saeed Serafizadeh, this was a huge pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Marie.
Thank you. That was Saeed Serafizadeh. The book, Brief Encounters with the Enemy, is out and available now. It's published by Dial Press, and it's a massive treat. We're going to take a short break. C.E. Poverman will be with me for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We will be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time.
I find this scientifically fascinating.
You're listening to KUCI Irvine.
Disengage this computer now.
Broadcasting at 88.9 FM.
Hello, computer.
And on the web at KUCI.org.
The most reliable computer ever made.
And streaming through iTunes.
Don't expect any mercy during the Great Robot Wars.
Anteater Radio brought to you by machines. Returning to normal broadcast in 3, 2, 1.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit KUCI.org or KUCITalk.org.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at KUCI.org. And we are always available via podcast. Feel free to visit us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. You can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. We have another great speaker series event coming up in a few short weeks. On Tuesday, September 10th, Ron Carlson, who you may know as the director of the MFA writing program here at UCI, will be at the Scape Gallery in Corona Del Mar in conversation with Barbara. His latest novel is The Signal from Viking. He's always a favorite among these events. I understand there are still some seats left, but they do sell out, so look up the details and ticket information on Barbara's website, penonfire.com. I'm your guest host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. I'm joined now by C.E. Poverman. C.E. Poverman's first book of stories, The Black Velvet Girl, won an Iowa School of Letters Award for short fiction. His second, Skin, was nominated for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. His stories have appeared in The O. Henry, Pushcart, and other anthologies. His previous novels are Susan, Solomon's Daughter, My Father in Dreams, and On the Edge. But it's his latest, Love by Drowning, published by El Leon Literary Arts, that we'll be discussing this morning. I hear he occasionally goes by Buzz, so with his indulgence this morning, maybe he'll let me call him that. Buzz, welcome. Are you there? Good morning. Oh, we don't have him anymore. I'm going to put on a little bit of music for your listening enjoyment. I'll try and get him back on the line, and we'll take it from there. Hold on just a moment. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I am now on with Buzz Poverman and his book, Love by Drowning. Buzz, you there?
I'm here.
Good morning.
Good morning to you.
So I'm going to give you a chance to introduce the novel and talk about sort of your inspiration for it, kind of the scope of it, and kind of take us into your world for a little bit.
Very good. I think the question people like to ask writers is, where does this story come from? And I think that's a fair question. And in my case, what went on with this novel was that maybe a year before I started writing this, I had read an article in a boating magazine about a guy who had been pulled overboard by a marlin and drowned. And I just sat up in my chair, and even reading this in a magazine just terrified me. And I clipped the article. I had no idea what I would do with it. But I did know that this had landed squarely in the middle of my fears. I'd grown up on boats, and we'd always had boats in my family. This was in Connecticut. And part of being on boats is, while they're wonderful, you can have very, very fast, sudden accidents. And so I always carried a deck knife in case something grabbed you. You could cut yourself out of the line. So maybe a year went by, and my father had died, and I'm living on the Connecticut shore, and my sister's brothers are there, and they're in the middle of their male rivalries, and I just started writing scenes, and I didn't know what I was writing, really, but I wrote all summer, just wrote scenes. It was like I was sleepwalking, and at the end of that time, I ran off the file. It was about 50 or 60 pages, and I all I knew was finally I would read a scene, and I would cut it out, and I had three piles, beginning, middle, and end, and that's all I knew. And then I started writing, and that was where it began.
Something strikes me about writing about your greatest fears, and, you know, even if my greatest fear and your greatest fear are different, the choice of you to go into the really dark place, whatever that is for you, produces this incredibly visceral, sort of immediate sense of foreboding that we can all relate to, even if, you know, even if our fears are different. It's writing into the dark places is a strong and powerful way to go.
Oh, I think that's true. You know, you don't choose the material. The material chooses you, just in the sense that I'm just sitting there, maybe, as I said, a year before, I'm casually just flipping through a magazine, and it's just, I encounter this thing that I don't know I'm going to encounter, and it strikes a chord in me. And in writing, you want the material in a way to pull you or to choose you, even though you as yet don't know what that material may actually be or mean.
Yeah.
You write to find out what it means.
Right, right. It's funny, we were talking in the first half hour about the great metaphor of your book, of this marlin pulling somebody over the edge of the boat, and what a great metaphor that is for writing itself, you know, that it really is writing that sort of is the force that's pulling you along behind it, and you're kind of along for the ride.
Mari, I became aware of that after I'd been writing the book for maybe a year or two. But, I mean, that is absolutely true.
The great fish. I love that.
Right, the fish metaphor. Yeah.
And, I also love this idea that, you know, these characters are so combustible. This character of Leanne is so combustible and you know, kind of on fire. And this sort of fire-water theme, or things kind of set in opposition to each other in dichotomy. It, was that something that was kind of consciously bubbling in your brain, or is that just sort of a subconscious ripple effect that goes under the novel?
I think that was subconscious. I mean, I'm The moment you said that, I suddenly saw it, but I had not thought of it in those terms or words before. You know, and when you're writing a book like this, the book has got water and oceans in it, you know, and it's also got boats in it, and at some point they become characters in themselves. They have their own life, and they exert their own force on the world of the other characters.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the setting and the backdrop in this is so present and so alive. In terms of character, let's talk a little bit about Leanne, because she's such a wonderful character, and I'm wondering about, A, accessing her as a woman, you know, writing women, writing complicated, combustible women. Tell me a little bit about the process of mining her character.
I sort of have all of my insight in retrospect, either during, while I'm writing, I start to understand, or afterward, I get a certain amount of retrospective understanding. And I don't know if I could have said this while I was writing Leanne, but I became aware that there were certain components of her. She had a gaze that both fascinated Val and yet repelled him. And no matter, as I would write over and over again, he had to see her, he wanted to see her eyes one more time. And he felt if he could just see her eyes one more time, he would understand something about her, something that was not right, something that did not make sense to him. And I can't reveal too much about that right now, I think, but he was getting a message about something. And I realized that at some point I'd had a relationship with a woman who had, I guess what you would call beautiful eyes. And whenever you looked at her, you really could not look away from her eyes. And yet, in combination with that, you never knew what was true or not with her. The combination of both being pulled by her gaze, but being just having a sense of, is this true? Is this a lie? What is what she's telling me? Is this the way it happened? Created a terrible push-pull.
How was that to write from her perspective, from her point of view, where, you know, you kind of have this unreliable, superficially unreliable character? Was it hard to access her when you were in her voice?
I think all of writing is about hearing a sound, finding the language, finding the voice of each character. And so for me, as long as I can find the voice of the character, whether it's a male or female, makes no difference once I find the voice. And so once I heard her voice, found her voice, I could write her with what I hope was complete authority, and I felt like once I was in her voice, I knew exactly everything she was going to do, what she was doing. I had a kind of empathy for it, sympathy, empathy.
Yeah, that's beautiful. My guest this morning is Buzz Poverman. Am I saying your last name right? I want to make sure I'm saying it right.
Poverman is
Poverman. Perfect.
Right, yeah.
Perfect. His book, Love by Drowning, is out and available now. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Let's talk a little bit about structure. So you said you sat down, you wrote 50 pages, and kind of put them into piles of beginning, middle, and end, which was a starting point. You know, the novel is big and expansive, and it struck me as I was reading it that the structure of this would be, you know, time is sort of fluid, everything is fluid in it, and I was wondering about assembling a collection, or assembling a novel where, you know, sort of the fish has taken over and pulled you along, and then, you know, you're left with, I don't know how many pages at the end that you kind of have to shape into the arc of a novel, and talk about that process.
Right. Time and structure in novels is absolutely crucial, and I had a pretty clear sense of the structure of this novel early on, and the thing that really sets the novel in motion is the event in the beginning with Val Davis and the Marlin, and that takes place in 1984. The next move or leap in time is 17 years later, and we go to Val's backyard, and he's talking to his wife and son. And so immediately, you have an incident in 1984, you have 17 years going by, and now you start moving forward in time in Val's life. And the novel moves forward from that time to through all the things that Val has to deal with. At the same time, the other part of the novel is its structure is at the same time that Val's moving forward in the present, we're getting the events that led up to the 1984 incident.
Right.
And then they converge maybe three-quarters of the way through the narrative, and then we go forward. But I would say that in this novel, more than any other novel I have ever written, time became a character in itself. There just seemed to be more time, more layers of time, more complexity of time. And I became very aware of handling that time in a kind of almost symphonic sense,
mm-hmm.
and making absolutely sure, and every time I read it or I worked with an editor or reread it, that the time and the tempo of that time was always clear to the reader, and if there was anything that just was even slightly off, you know, rewrite it, readjust it.
Did you have sort of storyboards or you know, notes all over your office or some way of kind of organizing this in your own mind to keep things straight so you didn't get lost in the forest from the trees?
I wish my notes were as organized as you just suggested. But no, it's more like, you know, I always write on a big desk, you know, an 8-foot wide desk, you know, plywood desk. And so the whole desk is covered with notes, and then notes about those notes, and then notes on the floor, and you know, if somebody opens the window, it's a disaster. If a little wind comes in the room, really, it's
a different novel.
It's a different novel, right? So,
I like your comparison of this to an orchestra. I've heard people say that before, and sort of, you know, in the reading of it, you say, okay, you know, I need a little more flute over here, or a little less bass over there, and you know, not just the arc of the novel, but kind of the moments of dark and light and humor, and you know, when the readers had too much, and sort of, you know, how to balance emotion and the rest of it, and time, and that seems like such a trick to me.
I think it's just a sense maybe of your own of what you can stand and what you need yourself, which is, it's just as you said, it's light here or it's dark here, I need some light, or it's whatever it is over here. But you know, life life goes against, you know, they tell writers write against the grain. In other words, write against what's conventional or cliched. But life does go against the grain in itself. I mean, if the conventional image of somebody getting bad news and bursting into tears, you know, if that's the stereotype, and maybe 50% of the people we know would do that, maybe the other 50% do something like go outside and go to a driving range and hit golf balls for an hour.
Yeah, right.
And that's against the grain. And so I think when you're writing a novel, you want to be attuned to the way in which things are going against the grain, relieving the darkness or so forth.
Right, right. Talk about your own experience inside this book, having finished it and, you know, kind of having written into this great fear of your own. Did the process of writing it reveal anything to you as writer or, you know, as human being, or did it alleviate some of the fears? Did it change your mind about anything? What did the process do to you as writer and as person?
Oh, that's a great question. Every book you write in some way, I think, really does something, creates a kind of alchemy in you, and if you're really writing it, and this book pushed me, every novel you finish, when you finish, you say, well, that's it, I can't do it anymore, it's too much. but this book really, really, really just, I just had the experience of, finally, the final draft of the book came out to be 440 pages in manuscript, but when I finished it, it was 680-700 pages. So, I wrote it for 5 years, and my experience of writing it was, no matter what I gave it, what I put into it, what I imagined, or whatever scenes I imagined for it, it was like putting material into a blast furnace. It just disappeared. It just superheated it, melted it down, and asked for more. And it was so you're trying to stay up with this process that's just, and in a way it's just scary. You're thinking, well, what's going on here? Can I go the distance with this thing? Whatever it is, whatever it wants, can I last long enough to do it? And so that was one very distinct experience of this book, that it just wanted more.
That sounds unique to this book more than the other things that you've written, or you've talked about that experience as being, that this book sort of was more consuming than maybe some of the work that you've done in the past.
I think so. I feel like I realized more facets of myself. You know, you're always trying to translate parts of yourself into a world and completely transform them, and I felt in some way what you're looking for as a writer is an organizing principle to a world of fragments that will allow you to translate yourself. And you're also looking for a playing field that the world can play out on. And I felt like this book allowed me to play out more of myself, translate more of myself, translate more facets. And then finally, it became greater than the sum of its parts. It was just, it was writing, which is what I've heard other writers talk about this, that it writes. And the more often you feel that it writes, the more you feel you've tapped into something beyond yourself, which is what you hope for.
Yeah, indeed. Oh, sadly, we never have enough time on the show, but we've drawn down on our time. But, Buzz, this was a great pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time. Can you tell us where to find you online, and maybe, I don't know if you have some upcoming events where people can find you out there?
Sure, cepoverman.com, and I had just last weekend in La Jolla signed books in Warwick's, and I think the next thing I will be in Tucson on Friday the 13th, September Friday the 13th at Clues Unlimited. I'll be giving a reading in the prose reading series at the University of Arizona on the 19th. And then I'm going east. I'll be at Mysterious in New York, RJ Julia in Madison, Connecticut. I'll be reading at the Athenaeum in Newport, the Redwood Library Athenaeum. So it's just going to go on for a while.
Yeah, we can find out more about you at your website, where you'll be. That's fantastic.
Right.
Wonderful. Buzz, thank you so much for taking the time this morning. This was a huge pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. That was C.E. Poverman. The book Love by Drowning is out and available now. That's all the time we have for today. Barbara will be right back with you next week at 9 a.m., so feel free to join us then. Stay tuned. Roots and Rhythms is coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.